All right, let's make sure you are in fellowship, and let's continue on here. We got just a little bit to wrap up verse 14. As Paul is working through this matter of the Philippian offering and his reaction to it, and his gratitude, obviously, for it, but again, not so much for the money as to what it represented. We were working on verse 14, "Nevertheless, you have done well by sharing with me in my affliction." And we left off here, the locative of sphere in point 14 identifies that in which the Philippians shared. It is seen in the term philipsis again, which is derived from a verb that means to press or squash, as in grapes or in wine production. So it's putting pressure on something, whatever the pressure may be. Again, it can be physical pressure, mental pressure, emotional pressure, spiritual pressure. Any of these things can qualify. So it is used metaphorically to denote pressure in the sense of various types of troubles that inflict distress. It is used of physical distress and suffering. For instance, Matthew chapter 13. This is in the parable of the soils here, talking about the type of person that succumbs to persecution, yet he has no firm root in himself, but is only temporary. And when affliction or persecution arises, affliction is the pressures and tests. Persecution is a more specific aspect of affliction. Being mistreated because of the word. But when this arises because of the word, you may not be persecuted because of the word, but people may put pressure on you because they don't like your stance. They may try to pressure you to conform to their viewpoint and all of that. So persecution can be a part of that, though. But obviously, we're talking about the physical sort of attacks or spiritual attacks even that come, the pressures people try to put on believers. Also, 24:9. Here, and this is one of the ways they will translate this word pretty frequently, is tribulation. They will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you. And then this obviously has to do with the physical aspects of life, ultimately death in the worst case scenario. And you will be hated by all the nations because of my name. The world had no room for Jesus when he was born. They still don't have any room for him. It hasn't changed. The cosmos is no more animated or interested in Jesus Christ than they are in the man in the moon. They may be more interested in the man in the moon. And so I hear all this, you know, I watch all these things that they're doing. Oh, we're going to be growing food on Mars. We found a place where there's water on the moon. I would suspect as thin as the atmosphere is, any liquid would evaporate and nothing flat there. It has nothing to hold it in. It's just space. So we'll see what they find, but again, we're still looking for intelligent life here. When we find that, then we can get excited, I guess. So the cosmos, again, they don't have room for any of this stuff. They're busy doing their own things. They think they're planning on another century or decades or however long they're planning on. But many people are noticeably worried that there's something up. They're scared. They're under pressure, and the demons, of course, have invaded the country, making it worse. You see all of this activity that is just symptomatic of demon activity. So it can also be used here in our verses, though, as well as mental suffering and anguish. For instance, 2 Corinthians, Paul uses it in that context in the matter of dealing with the incestuous Corinthian and the fallout from that. And he's describing, his situation that led up to this, for out of much affliction and anguish of heart. Now here he's clearly talking about the emotional impact that this had on him, the spiritual impact that the church was being dragged down, and he knew it. It did not look good in front of the cosmos. The church's reputation was suffering. Even the cosmos, he said, wouldn't do some of the things these people were doing, this one in specific. But this is about that particular deal, and he had to write and he had to address all this and deal with it. That's part of the pastoring deal. But if you, I think, to teach doctrine, hopefully sufficiently over the years, the congregation has an amazing way of monitoring itself, I think. And the fact is, believers, by their application or lack thereof, by their commitment or lack thereof, put pressure on people. And that's okay. That's a legitimate pressure. So I, out of much affliction and anguish of heart, I wrote to you with many tears, not that you would be made sorrowful, but so that you might know the love which I have especially for you. And Paul still wants the best for these people. Uses agape there. But he didn't say oida here. He didn't say no. He said ginosko. Maybe you can figure this out, hopefully, that you can see these actions of mine and put them in their proper perspective and understand what's going on here. Because the Corinthians didn't understand a lot of things, as we know. So 16, while there have been some creative suggestions as to what the suffering in view was, it simply refers to the matter of Paul's imprisonment and the pressures and testing associated with that reality. So in that regard, Paul never makes the monetary gift the most important matter in all of this. Rather, he focuses on what the monetary gift represented. When he talks about this, they shared with him. And while there is no doubt that the money they sent was intended to alleviate the physical needs of the prisoner, I mean, that would be the first thing you would think they were going to do with it. Paul needed food, clothing. He would be able to purchase these things. He obviously had to pay for that apartment that he was renting as well, his own quarters. That was on him as well, too. So if you were in prison in Rome, it's not like being in prison here, where they put you up, they feed you, they clothe you, they make sure you have exercise and all that. Oh, nothing like that at all. That's a country club compared to where Paul was and what he was going through. So there's no doubt that they were sent to alleviate that, but it represented more than that should be van money. It was an expression of the fact that the believers in Philippi were partners with the apostle in the larger task of proclaiming the gospel, and this matter of sharing with him in his affliction expressed their actual deep-seated concern for him, that they cared about Paul and that they wanted what was best for him. So 19, as some have noted, this is perhaps the closest Paul comes to saying thank you. But this phrase does not actually mean that. And rather, it communicates commendation and praise for their application. And 20, as Peterman has noted, this phrase is not that of a client praising some patron or benefactor, but rather sounds like the teacher commending and congratulating his students. And I believe that was right on point. That's exactly what this is. Now, moving on here, our next verse, 15. You yourselves know. Now you yourselves know. You have here the conjunction duh, which introduces either a shift, an addition, or some further information. Here, he's referring back now to the historical past and what they were aware of. Now, you all know oida also here. In addition to Paul, Paul knows about this. Obviously, he's the one that knows about it, and so he says, you know, too. So what you the word order here is not what we would have in the English, but you do have the pronoun su, which is emphatic in this case, the nominative plural of that, you yourselves, and that's how you reflect that when you have that distinct usage of this. So you yourselves know, and then the chi here is adjunctive also. You yourselves know also. Although they don't translate the also here in our stuff. So you yourselves know Philippians. Philippians here is evocative. This is the voice of address, Philippasios. That's what it sounds like in the Greek, P-H, Philippesios. Philippesios. Evocative, again, he's addressing them directly. You yourselves know that. Hadi here, when used with oida very often. Gnosko, oida, some verbs like that. Speaking verbs also. Thinking verbs. Hadi often introduces the content of what is known. It has another use of as causal, but here content. You yourselves know, Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, preposition in here, when used of the locative of time, first, at the beginning or commencement of something. So they've translated here not in, but at, which is fine. That at the first preaching of the gospel. The gospel, of course, is what is proclaimed, the good news. And the gospel is what is being proclaimed, so this is probably a subjective genitive. The gospel is being proclaimed. That, at that time, hata is our conjunction here, our adverb. Hata, that at the time, after I had left Macedonia, after having left, or after I had left, is exerchomai. Exerchomai. Erchomai simply means to come or to go. Has the idea of to go out from, to depart from. So when I departed, this has kind of the force of a pluperfect, after I had left, even though it's not a pluperfect, it's here just an aorist. After I had left from, and of course this isn't translated typically, the preposition here, apo, with the ablative to denote separation. After I had departed from Macedonia, or after I had left Macedonia. No church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. No one, absolutely here, udais, negative u with the numeral heis, E-O-U-D-E-I-S, udais. No one, not one, with me. This is the dative object of fellowship. It comes from koinoneo. No church shared with me here. He was the one they were sharing with. No church. And then you have our word, as you would imagine, ekklesia. E-K-K-L-E-S-I-A. No one, no church. Not one, literally, church. It's kind of more emphatic. Not one church shared with me. With me, into, shared is again koinoneo, that's our verb there, partnered with me, shared with me, fellowshipped with me, in the word. Literally into, you got ice with the accusative of logos. Into the word, into the message. The gospel obviously is this matter. Sometimes it's here it's used in terms of matter. Like a thing or a matter. That's one of the ways this word is used. Here used, here, one of the things they do here, and although this is a little bit crass, I don't think Paul intended at all to be crass, but the language here is of one having a set of books, and they have credits and debits. Now, Paul doesn't really view their relationship in terms of money by any stretch of the imagination. But the language here is the language of accounting and the language of sharing and giving, receiving. These things were commonly used in those in that way. So we'll translate it here as matter. In the matter of giving is actually dosis, D-O-S-I-S. Genitive feminine singular. Two times this can refer either to the act of giving or to the thing given. The matter of giving and chi, connective here, and receiving. Lempsis. L-E-M-P-S-I-S. This the verb, lambano, this is where this comes from. So we would talk here the matter of giving and receiving. If not, what you have here is the hypothetical conjunction I, EI, with the negative may. And I may has the idea of if not or except. And very often that's the way they've translated here, but you, except would have been better. Except, you were the exception to this. And that's the language that he uses. They are exceptional in this regard. With the matter of giving and receiving, except you all alone. You all is the plural of Sue, and then you have monos, but it's actually a plural, interestingly enough, this adjective. Monos means alone or only or a single, the one thing. But here is this, you all alone ones. It would be the literal of it. But again, he's talking to the whole group. That's the point here, that the church itself. For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift to me more than once to meet this need. Even in Thessalonica, for is actually hoti. Here you got a causal use of hoti, H-O-T-I, because, and of course, you can treat it causally or you can continue it as the content of, and that's kind of actually what I did here. I see this as continuing the content of what they know. That they know that they shared with him. They know they'd send him a gift. As a matter of fact, as we're going to find out, when he said, I departed from Macedonia, they'd send him money before he departed Macedonia. But obviously they continued after he left that province to support him. So, for even, or better yet, I translate it for because or that, depending upon what you want to go with here, you yourselves know that even in Thessalonica, they would know this as well, that even, you have chi here, sensitive, that even, and the reason he singles this out, why is Thessalonica so important? Well, because it's still in the province of Macedonia. So, he hadn't fully even left the province before they began to support him. So, if not you alone, for even in Thessalonica, and with the locative of Thessalonike, the city there, you sent a gift to me more than once to meet this need, literally what you've got here is you've got two chi's here. And normally when you have chi, it's usually translated here, both, da-da-da, whatever it is, and something else, whatever it is. So literally what he has here is both once, and the word here we've got is hapax. H-A-P, this is why I want to talk about Greek words. Hapax is a word that only occurs one time. Literally, the more fuller phrase is hapax legomena, spoken only once, or said only once. Both once and again is really what he's saying here, once and twice. You got hapax, and then you have this adverb dis, D-I-S. It means twice or again. So the idiom here, both once and twice, means more than once. And that's the way the New American Standard is has rendered it here. With respect to the need, you sent to me, you sent a gift. Well, they've supplied there, as you can see, a gift. We don't actually get the verb here till the end of the verse. You sent a gift. It's money, obviously, that they sent. And the here, you got a definite article, probably should be translated as my need, because sometimes the article functions like a pronoun, and then you have the need, and then you have you sent to me, the verb, the simple verb to pimpo. This is a verb with just means they sent something, has no idea of authority or doesn't tell you anything like that. It was just something was sent. And then to me, the indirect object of pimpo, the verb there. So now you yourselves know, O Philippians, that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I had left Macedonia, and of course the first preaching of the gospel, he's not referring to the beginning of his ministry, he's talking about the preaching of the gospel there in their province, in Macedonia and in Philippi. that at the first preaching of the gospel, after I had left Macedonia, no church shared with me in the matter of giving and receiving, but you alone. For even in Thessalonica, you sent a gift to me more than once to meet my need, is the way I would probably translate that now. Because the need then wasn't the same as the need is now. The need now is he's in prison. He can't provide for himself. Whatever he may have needed back then, prison wasn't part of it. But they still sent money, of course, to support him. All right, point one here. These two verses constitute a single sentence in the Greek text, which contains the main verb oida, along with two clauses that are each introduced by the conjunction hadi. Now, the first clause there in verse 15, you know that, and then that's the first clause, at the preaching of the gospel and all that. And then in the second one, it doesn't pick up till verse 16, that even in Thessalonica. You know that as well, because you did it. So too, Paul begins with the conjunction duh, which is not translated in the New American Standard, but introduces a reminder of what the Philippians had done for Paul previously. What he's bringing up here is a look back to the past. So obviously when he says, I forget those things that lie behind, he didn't forget the applications people made towards him. These are things to dwell on, the good things. This would be one of those good things that you would think about. Those people really applied towards me. Three here, Paul follows that with an adjunctive use of the conjunction chi. And that's translated also when you use it in that way, which indicates that Paul certainly remembered their support, and he uses it to remind the Philippians of their applications. The idea here is that you know as I do, and that's what he's getting at here. It's knowledge they both have. You know as well as I do. So the pronoun sou here is coupled with the verb oida, to add emphasis, and means you yourselves know. So that's the fuller thing would hear, if you translate it more literally, I think it would be, you yourselves know as well as I do how this went. He then used a vocative form of Philippasios. This is a citizen of Philippi. And Paul uses a Latinized form since it was appropriate for the citizens of a Roman colony. Because probably the vast bulk of them there are Romans. There didn't appear to be hardly any. Again, if there was no synagogue, there wasn't much of a Jewish population at all. And we don't know how many people were around that area, but they would have been displaced when the Romans came in and took over the city, more or less. They were stationed there. So some of them probably left. So six, it is unusual for Paul to address those in local churches like this. Both of the other occasions involved exasperation or rebuke. To use the vocative here and address the whole church is something he didn't normally do, Galatians 3:1. But when he does it, it's usually bad. Oh, stupid Galatians. Anoetos means to not have any thinking, to have no mind. To be unthinking, to lack knowledge. They translate it as foolish, which is fine, but we would probably more generally use the word stupid today. You stupid Galatians, who has bewitched you? Well, that's clearly not a good context. He's addressing them and he's exasperated with them. And also 2 Corinthians, here's another place where he does it. 6:11. And again, he's frustrated at some level with the Corinthians because they are blowing him off, paying attention to these faulty people, false apostles, false teachers coming in there. They're not really being, and that's what he's saying to them here. Our mouth has spoken freely to you, O Corinthians. Our heart is opened wide. You are not restrained by us. But you're restrained in your own affections. And because, see, they were alienated from Paul mentally and emotionally. They didn't really want him around for whatever. They were more happy with some of these other teachers, sadly. Rather than get the truth, they would settle for something far less. Again, Satan disguising himself as an angel of light. So in this case, the term should be taken as an expression of Paul's gratitude. Philippians, back to Philippians 4 here. Should be taken here. You yourselves know, oh, Philippians, this is a good thing. The stuff he's going to talk about is the commendation of them. And not some way of covering any supposed exasperation. So Paul reminds them of their initial contact with him. He had been working in Asia Minor when he received a vision directing him to the province of Macedonia. That was seen in the book of Acts. This is how they end up in Philippi. Acts chapter 16. Verses 9 through 12. Now, actually, verse 6 is germane to this, too. Because when they had passed through the Phrygian and Galatian region, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia, for whatever reason, the timing wasn't right, most likely, is what I would suspect, is that the timing just wasn't right yet. They're going to evangelize this area eventually. But there was a more, apparently, more positive volition that was ready. And that positive volition was in Macedonia. So a vision, point 9, appeared to Paul in the night. A man of Macedonia was standing and appealing to him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. They were across the strait there. They were on the Turkey side of that, and then they would have had to go on up across to get into that region. So putting out to sea, well, of course, yeah, there's a port there, from Troas, we ran a straight course to Samothrace. And on the next day, following to Neapolis. Neapolis was the port city of Philippi, I believe. It was on the coast there. Samothrace was an island out there. And from there to Philippi, which is a leading city in the district of Macedonia, a Roman colony. And we were staying in this city for some days. And Luke goes out of his way to draw attention to this stuff. So this is important stuff for him. The fact this is the only Roman colony that they deal with is one thing. That's one. It really stands out here. So that was their first meeting with him. Paul and his company show up there in Philippi. So the first prepositional phrase is literally translated at the beginning of the gospel, which seems to have confused a number of interpreters. However, the prepositional phrase, en arche, in a beginning, is not technical. The noun arche does not refer to a single beginning. There's a lot of beginnings mentioned in the scriptures even, but is used to reference a number of beginnings in the Bible. And so, A, the first beginning is actually a reference to eternity past. That is found in the book of John, the Gospel of John, there. John 1:1. And this word is not used articulately. It's never in the beginning, but they always supply the definite article there when they're dealing with it in the New American Standard. I've noticed that because we tend to think of a beginning, when something starts, and we tend to think of it definitely. There are a lot of things started in God's plan over the course of history. So eternity past in a beginning, literally, was the Word. And the Word was face-to-face with God, looking at God, pros, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God, obviously a reference to the pre-incarnate Son. Although not called a beginning, it's not referenced as a beginning, but the angels were created next. Ezekiel 28:13, this one's a specific angel. Ezekiel 28:13. You were in Eden, the garden of God. This is all. This is a passage in here. Ezekiel 28 is addressing Satan. It goes beyond the earthly king of Tyre or the prince of Tyre. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Well, that couldn't have been true of anybody other than Adam and Eve and the serpent. So this easily interprets itself, I think. Every precious stone was your covering. The ruby. Now, that some have suggested here, that, again, that they're not talking about the Eden on planet Earth, but this was a spiritual Eden Because what we're not, Eden on planet Earth talked about in terms of foliage, vegetation, trees, fruit, and stuff. Well, this is talking about in terms of valuable commodities. Every precious stone was your covering. The ruby, the topaz, the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the lapis lazuli, the turquoise, and the emerald. And the gold and the workmanship of your sockets and settings was in you. On the day that you were created, bummer. It's going to be hard to be God if you're created. It's going to be real difficult for you. You can't make it. Not going to happen. They were prepared. You were the anointed cherub that covers. He had this particular place that God, and God says, I placed you there. You were on the holy mountain of God. You walked in the midst of the stones of fire. You were blameless in your ways from the day you were created until unrighteousness was found in you. And Satan, of course, at that point, he falls. He experiences a series of falls. The five I wills of Isaiah 14 are balanced by a series of five falls. First, his fall from holiness. He's no longer perfect anymore. Then his demotion out of the throne room. He was demoted from that anointed cherub that covers position. We're not told what happened. We're just told he's no longer that. And then his third fall is going to be when he's going to be confined to planet Earth at around the midpoint of Daniel's 70th week. His fourth fall will be into the pit, the abyss, where he'll spend 1,000 years. Each fall, by the way, as you might note, gets successively lower and longer. The fifth fall is the permanent one. It's the fall from which he will never recover. That's the fall into the lake of fire. And that's where he'll spend eternity, being the most maligned creature there. The idea that Satan rules in hell is a joke. He doesn't. He's going to be the lowest of the low in hell. Nobody rules in hell, by the way. Also, Job 38, 6 and 7. Here's the documentation that the angels pre-existed the physical creation. So they, obviously angels, whatever their bodies are comprised of or however they function, they obviously don't need a material space to function. They can function without atmosphere. They can function without anything. But they're much more like the Lord in their nature. They're spiritual creatures. So Job 38:6, here 6 and 7. On what were the earth's bases sunk? Oh, see, it's got bases. It's flat. Who laid its cornerstone? This is figurative language. If you can't figure that out, if you can't figure out the figurative, you're going to be a wooden-headed literalist all your life. So when the morning stars sang together, and the morning stars are balanced with this parallel clause here, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. The morning stars and the sons of Elohim are angels. Stars are used to refer to angels. They also are used to refer to literal stars too. But they're used to refer to angels. And so when this wall came into existence, when it was spoken into existence, the angels were worshiping spectators and they saw all this. So that's a beginning. The beginning of the physical creation. And again, the first beginning, the reference to eternity past, isn't even actually, it's a beginning, because at some point you begin at least what we would consider the idea of a sequence in time. Although time is not a factor back then. But obviously God does things in a particular order. See, the next beginning chronologically is a reference to the creation of the material universe. That is documented there in Job, but Genesis 1:1, everybody probably knows this verse, probably by heart. In the beginning, and again, it's not articular in the Hebrew either, and even in the Greek, it's not in the Septuagint, in a beginning. In a beginning, Elohim created two things, the heavens and the earth, which is a comprehensive for all material creation. That's what he's talking about. All material creation was spoken into existence. God the Son actually did the work. That's called a beginning. The beginning of the material universe. The creation of mankind is called a beginning. Matthew 19:4. Here in the context, of course, of marriage. From a beginning. Now you have the creation and the formation of mankind. And he answered and said, have you not read that he who created them from a beginning. Again, they're going to make this definite in the English because that's the way the Western mind sort of thinks. But this is another beginning. He made them male and female. The fall of Satan and the introduction of sin into the universe is called a beginning. Now that one occurred between C and D. Maybe I should have reversed the order on this one a little bit. But just to know chronologically, Satan fell after the creation of the material universe, but before the creation of mankind. And that's the passage there in Genesis 1:2, and the earth became without form and void. This brings up a whole bunch of questions most interpreters never even answered. Why? First, you've got these two distinct articles marked off in the Hebrew with the sign of the direct object in the verse 1. The heavens and the earth were created. Why did only the earth become without form and void? And without form, formless in what way? And void of what? Void of inhabitants. So who were the pre-Adamic inhabitants of earth? It could have only been angels, and very likely fallen angels, that Satan decided that this was the planet he wants. And this is where he's going to rule his kingdom from. And so there's this fight over planet Earth and who's going to have control of it. Satan has moved in and taking a squatter's position. I'm here, you can't get rid of me. Possession is, in this case, 9/10 of the law. And he will get rid of him eventually. But at this point, he's letting him squat. And also letting man kind of destroy God's... One of the things you see in that... there's a passage in the book of Revelation. I think it's in... maybe it's in the passage in 18 on Babylon, but it may be somewhere else. But it talks about the men who are destroying the earth. That there are things that we are doing that are not really healthy for a long-term sustainable deal. Obviously, the heavy use of plastics, the incredible pollution that's out there, and all of that. Well, Satan falls in between the material creation. The earth became without form and void. Why? Because judgment fell on it. And that's symbolized by the very next verse, darkness was on the surface of the deep. Darkness had settled in, indicating that whatever the deal was before, darkness wasn't a part of. But darkness is now introduced. These are all the clues that tell you that Satan has fallen. Between his creation and the formation of the earth, somehow he has fallen. Or after the creation of the earth, after material creation came into existence. 1 John 3:8. The one who practices sin is of the devil. Now note here again, too, John here, this is a little problematic because he doesn't use the word practice. He uses the word poieo, to do. One might say, he who commits a sin is of the devil. Uh-oh. That puts us all in a bad spot, but it's actually an articular participle. The one doing, which even though he doesn't use proso, it has the force of ongoing action. That the one doing sin is the sinner. The one doing the sin is the sinner. And the sinner, again, those who are unregenerate, is of the devil. For the devil has sinned from a beginning. And it doesn't say what the beginning is, but his sin, his initial sin, of course, was pride. But we also know he's committed other sins, like he committed the sin of murder. He spiritually murdered Adam and Eve. So he has committed other sins. So the introduction of Satan and the sin, or the introduction of sin in the universe, is called a beginning. The ministry of John the Baptist and the gospel of Christ is referred to as a beginning. In the book of Mark there, 1:1 in fact. And so when he talks about the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God, he's talking about the introduction of the formal gospel into the material world now. God's always had this plan. It's not as though he didn't know about it. But it had to have a point at which it actually started in human history. And this point is called a beginning. Also 1:4. John the Baptist appeared in the wilderness, preaching a baptism of repentance for the forgiveness of sin. And this John the Baptist, this is the initial onset of the gospel of Jesus Christ, and it begins with the forerunner. And that's what he's pointing out here. And then also, what's the last one? Verse 14. Now after John had been taken into custody, Jesus came into Galilee preaching the gospel of God. The gospel of the kingdom, the gospel of Jesus Christ, the gospel of God, these are all synonyms. Each may have its own specific nuance, but it's referring to the same process, the same ministry. The church age began on the day of Pentecost, which is called a beginning. Acts 11:15. So there's lots of beginnings. There are a number of them anyway. Maybe not lots, but several. And as I began to speak, he's now here rehearsing what happened there in the household of Cornelius as he took the gospel to the Gentiles. This is Peter talking. As I began to speak, the Holy Spirit fell on them just as he did on us at the beginning. And the day of Pentecost, obviously, that's the beginning of the church age. Now, there's an ending to that as well, too. By the way, every beginning implies an ending at some point. That we believe that there's a telic force to God's plan. There's a telic force in the world. And that means bringing it to a conclusion, bringing it to an end. And so the devil's sin, it's going to have an end. He's not going to be able to just do this forever. There, Acts 11:15, the way it happened just to those Gentiles, just as it happened to us at Pentecost, so what could I do? This is kind of Peter's argument. When the gospel is brought to a new era, a new area, rather, it's referred to as a beginning. That's our verse there in Philippians here, 4:15. That's the verse we're looking at now. At the beginning of the gospel. Well, obviously, that's not the beginning of the gospel, but it was the beginning of the gospel in that region. And then entrance into the Christian life and phase two sanctification is also called a beginning. Obviously, your Christian life had a beginning. Started at some point. 1 John 2:24. As for you, let that abide in you which you heard from the beginning. And this is the beginning of their Christian life. Their exposure to the gospel, their acceptance of it, and the beginning of their actual experience in all of this. If what you heard from the beginning abides in you, then you also will abide in the Son and in the Father. So 11 here, while there have been at least four suggestions as to what this prepositional phrase means, it simply refers to the time during which the Philippians became acquainted with Paul and heard the gospel of Jesus Christ. And we know all recorded for us in the book of Acts. And he brought the message to them. And largely it appears that there were no guys there. That it appears that this was basically a group of women. There's no mention of a guy here. And on the Sabbath day, we went outside the gate to a riverside, the gate of the city there of Philippi, where we were supposing there would be a place of prayer. And we sat down and began speaking to the women who had assembled. And a woman named Lydia from the city of Thyatira, a seller of purple fabrics, a worshiper of God, was listening. And the Lord opened her heart to respond to the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, saying, "If you judge me to be faithful to the Lord, come into my house and stay." And she prevailed upon us. And then, of course, you get into the rest of the time in Philippi, not so much fun. So this beginning of the gospel, which was referenced in the first chapter, where Paul speaks of their partnership from the first day, that this is his view of all of this, that they grabbed the ball and ran with it. I mean, initially, Philippians 1:5, in view of your participation in the gospel from the first day, from the beginning, that would be the day where he evangelized them. And we don't know how many. I presume more than Lydia believed, though. I mean, he wouldn't have baptized her household without a profession of faith. I don't believe that. But I believe there were also other people there that got saved that day. They're just not particularly mentioned. So the phrase, in the beginning of the gospel, not only identifies the beginning of their partnership, it provides the basis for that partnership. Their partnership is in the gospel itself. And all that requires of Paul, say, as an apostle, to be traveling around, to take the gospel to new areas that hadn't been evangelized, to be responsible for those churches in his canon that he had to keep up with, providing what food and comfort and encouragement and teaching they needed. And that was a big job. Well, that required a lot of support. And not just financial support, obviously the physical support of people helping him, of doing things, engaging in, for instance, Timothy no doubt had a teaching ministry because we know he was left in Ephesus and told to devote himself to that. And so, and we know other of these people did too. Like Titus, we know that he traveled around, certainly went over the island of Crete, establishing pastors for these churches that had been evangelized. So the gospel is not only what brings them together, it's the basis for what they're doing. And it's this partnership in the gospel that means so much to God's plan. So the bond that brought Paul and the Philippians together was actually the third partner in this arrangement. The Lord, through the gospel, is the reason that this partnership existed in the first place. And so when we talk about the partnership between Paul and the Philippians, always have in the back of your mind that it's a three-way partnership. The Philippians have a partnership with the Lord. The Philippians have a partnership with Paul. And Paul has a partnership with the Lord. And Paul has a partnership with the Philippians. So it's a three-way partnership, we might say. But the silent partner is the one that really controls it. The silent partner. Although not always silent. So 15, based on Paul's financial policy when entering a new area, it is unlikely he would have taken money while in Philippi. Although, and this to me stands out. This is unusual because I don't think Paul normally did this. He does accept hospitality from Lydia. We saw that. She prevailed upon him. You know how pushy some women can be when they want something. But if she's trying to do something good, I mean, obviously this is not pushy in a bad way. We've all met some horsey women, and they can be pushy. But she was obviously trying to encourage them and prevail upon them so she could be a blessing to them. And I think it says she prevailed on them, that she had to talk them into this, that Paul wasn't really keen on immediately, because he argues this with the Thessalonians later. He said, you know that we didn't eat anybody's bread without paying for it. So I would presume this means we didn't stay with anybody for free. We paid our own way while we were there and did what we had to do. So while he does accept, again, some hospitality from Lydia, that was a bit unusual, which probably speaks to the kind of people these Philippians were, and that Paul picked up on it pretty quick, that they were a group that was ready to run with this. And some people are like that. Some people get saved, and I mean, they're out of the chute and they're ready to go. Other people, they get saved and they just sort of get to it eventually, I guess. But you see that there's differences in responses. So 16, what Paul does mention specifically is the time following his work in Philippi, after he had departed from the province of Macedonia. But 17, Paul did not depart Macedonia immediately upon leaving Philippi. He traveled through some other cities in that province and stopped in Thessalonica. Now that's seen in the book of Acts 17. 16 was the founding there of the church in Philippi. But Acts 17... And here's the deal, the journey. They were over in here. Actually, see, they were up in here in Phrygian region and Mysia, and they were told not to put the gospel into any of this area yet. They go up to Troas, come across there, there's Samothrace, Neapolis is the port city. Philippi, Amphipolis. Amphipolis, Apollonia, Thessalonica, and Berea. And that's kind of the route that he took, as again in Acts 17. And when they had traveled through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Okay, so this tells you this wasn't a Roman colony. There was a significant Jewish population here, or there wouldn't have been a synagogue. And according to Paul's custom, and of course for Paul, the synagogue was tailor-made for what he did. This was perfect. People are there theoretically to want to learn about God and his plan. And what a better place to go in and start. And according to his custom, he went to them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the scriptures, explaining and giving evidence that Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, saying, "This Jesus whom I am proclaiming to you is the Messiah. This Jesus of Nazareth, the historical man, this is your promised Messiah." And some of them were persuaded and joined Paul and Silas, along with a large number of God-fearing Greeks and a number of the leading women. And again, here there seems to be a fair amount of positive volition among women during this period in the beginning stages. And obviously there were more converts, it appears, certainly from the Gentiles in these kinds of things than there ever were from the Jews. But as we know, essentially that's what's happening. Gentile positive volition's going like this, Jewish positive volition's going like this, and about to tank. So obviously there were reasons why more of these people believed. They were more ready for it. Some of the God-fearers and other Greeks, and again, they're just Gentiles, but they'll call them Greeks, here they were attracted to the monotheism of the Jews. Some people recognize this idea of a bunch of gods is nuts. You know? And so all the Gentiles out there weren't, you know, Paul talks about them, you're walking in darkness, your deeds were evil, you're, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's all true, but there were people that wanted to learn God's plan, wanted to know. And they were positive, and God has to provide for them, and he did. So when he departed there, obviously, he heads through these other cities. And that's all still, by the way, oh, I can't leave that open. That's the problem with it. All of this, by the way, he's still here, and this is all still the province of Macedonia. These are all still in that province till you get further down here. So following the riot that was instigated by the negative Jews, Paul was sent out of Thessalonica under the cover of darkness and went to Berea. And that's in Acts 17, 10, and 11. They stirred up the crowd. There were some people here. In Thessalonica, the Jews becoming jealous and taking some wicked men from the marketplace. There's always a bunch of lowlifes out there hanging out in the parking lot, you know. Formed a mob and set the city in an uproar. Attacking the house of Jason, they wanted to bring him out to the people. And when they couldn't find them, they began dragging Jason and some of the brothers before the city authorities, shouting, "These men who have upset the world have come here also." Well, you couldn't give them any greater commendation, could you? They've turned the world on its ear already. And they recognize this. And Jason has welcomed him, that dirty dog. And they all act contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying there is another king, Jesus. And they stirred up the crowd, and the city authorities heard these things. And when they had received a pledge from Jason and the others, they released them. But the brothers immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. Snuck him out of town. I mean, this is dangerous stuff. And when they arrived, they went into the synagogue of the Jews. Now, these were more noble-minded than those in Thessalonica. The Jews were of a different, little better quality, we might say. Better Jews. At least more open-minded, more noble-minded. For they received the word with great eagerness, examining the scriptures daily to see if these things were so. And so because of their intellectual honesty and positive volition, they respond to the truth. Other people, the truth just makes them mad. Again, the same clay, the same sun that hardens clay softens butter. So the same gospel, same God, same message, and yet you get two wildly different responses depending upon the volitional pattern of the people. All right, well, our time is gone. We're going to go ahead and stop there today. We will pick up here on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our encouragement and growth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.